Okay, well then, since it looks like everybody's here, let's just go ahead and get started tonight. We're starting with a new tort. This is intentional infliction of emotional distress. It mirrors in a lot of ways other intentional torts we've had, battery assault, false imprisonment. But it's also different in that it's got a different focus. We're focused primarily on emotional injury or mental injury. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be coupled with a physical harm or physical manifestation of emotional injury, but primarily we're focused on that kind of behavior. It's unlike the other intentional torts in that there's actually, in many jurisdictions, a recklessness tort that's very similar. So in the reading that we have for Friday, we're still in intentional infliction of emotional distress, but stylized under recklessness. So, you know, realize it's not exactly like the other intentional torts we had last semester. It's also unique in that it's coupled with a negligence variety as well. So after we finish intentional infliction of emotional distress, we'll deal with negligent infliction of emotional distress. The first of these, intentional infliction of emotional distress, has actually been much more favored by the law than negligent infliction of emotional distress. And it's in part because the law has kind of always felt that emotional injuries can somehow be made up, basically, and that it's hard for us to ferret out what's legitimate from what's not. And so as you're reading through this material, kind of keep that in mind, that that's a big concern that people have. The law hasn't really kept up with the medical profession, which does recognize emotional injury and emotional impact. The law kind of sees it as a little bit more problematic. All right. So we've seen emotional harms appear in our other torts. Think about it, battery, assault, false imprisonment, negligence, all had emotional harm as something that could be appended to the physical injury. So for these ones, let's try and think of them as the freestanding ones, where we really are just suing for your emotional injury, not because you broke your leg and you're depressed. That's not negligent infliction of emotional distress, or not what we think of as the traditional sense of it. All right. So let's go ahead and figure out, by looking at the Wilkinson case, which is before the pot of gold case that's in the reading. If you look at 647, Wilkinson is discussed in the introduction here. This one is where a man appears at a plaintiff's house and, as a practical joke, falsely informs her that her husband's been smashed up in an accident and suffered two broken legs, all of which was just not true. All right, and the problem we have here is, could Wilkinson recover for this kind of conduct, for the practical joke, under any of the torts we've learned so far? Okay, why not? Why not battery?
No contact.
No contact. Excellent. See, more we get this back, the quicker this goes. Why not assault?
No
apprehension of contact. Hey, so you're doing great. Why not false imprisonment? No imprisonment whatsoever. Why not negligence? Well, there is. They're claiming some damage here. They're claiming the emotional distress. Why isn't it negligence? Well, there is injury. Arguably doing another person. But when we're talking about negligence, we're talking about creating foreseeable risks of harm created out of unreasonable conduct. And there's really no risk of harm created here in the kind of sense we think about with negligence. It's not like it made it more or less likely that she was to suffer a physical injury, which is really what we're talking about in negligence, in traditional negligence. You know, realize there's always been some sort of physical injury with an emotional attached to it, if anything. All right, so that's why these claims aren't here. But why do you think they would allow it in a case like Wilkinson? Why do they allow that? What was the motivation? I mean, this is sort of before the tort really existed. It was kind of driven by, you know, judicial thought of this should be recoverable for. Why do you think they did it? Okay, so there is something like that's beyond the pale to it, really, you know, to tell this person that their loved one is seriously, seriously injured. You can expect, objectively almost, that there's going to be some emotional distress from it. Yeah. Yeah,
and
a lot of ways you
want
to deter this kind of conduct. Yeah.
There was a physical way to measure the damages and things like nausea, physical
Okay, well, in this particular case, we see that, and we're going to put that under a term we're going to call physical manifestation. We're going to get back to that when we talk about negligent infliction of emotional distress. For intentional infliction, physical manifestation, while they talk about in the cases, like all the discussion about nausea and diarrhea and all that stuff, it's very unpleasant, but the law really at first wanted to see some sort of physical attribute of your anxiety and just didn't trust that this is anxious. That's not true anymore of intentional infliction of emotional distress. We're going to see that later. In this case, because she has that, it makes it more clear that it's something we want to cover. But in this kind of case, it's something that an average person would expect to see some emotional distress from. It's extreme conduct. And really, it's intentional. It's intentional. They meant for this to cause her distress. That's why they told her it wasn't accidental. Even though it was a joke, they meant for her to have some distress. All right, let's talk about the Nickerson case and figure out, again, we're going to walk through why this starts creating this new law that we're starting to see in intentional infliction of emotional stress. After we do this one, we're going to talk about the Dickinson case and nail down the elements of IID. So these two initial cases are before the claim is actually really out there in the books. Just, you know, some examples, spotty examples, that the torts restatement authors are going to gather together and say, hey, we've got this new tort that's starting to be created, and we're going to make it something with real elements. So we're still out in law. We're still new laws developing, kind of percolating with this Wilkinson case. So what happened to poor Miss Wilkinson? I'm sorry, poor Miss Nickerson. Wilkinson was the last one. They're both poor. So and so, yes?
She went to a fortune teller, told her that a pot of gold is buried in
them Deer Hills, yes.
Yeah,
all right.
Under the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So she went and started searching for this pot of gold.
Mm-hmm.
The guy allowed it. So here she is digging, and the people thought it would be a fun joke to put a pot where she was looking that day, and in there it had a note saying, do not open it, take it directly to a bank, and call all the...
Call the relatives in.
Mm-hmm. And so she does all this, and... she goes through a whole bunch of...
They kept this going for a long time, because mind you, like, this was supposed to be an April Fool's joke, and it wasn't like till April 15th that she actually discovers this pot of gold. So, I mean, they really are putting a lot of effort into really pulling the wool over her eyes. All right. In the meantime, the bankers, everybody starts hearing, she found the gold, you know, at first, because people are snickering back. That's not very nice. Poor Miss Nickerson. All right, so they say, she found the gold. You know, it's kind of a town rumor, because I'm sure, you know, in a small town, Miss Nickerson and her hunt for the pot of gold was pretty much known by everybody. It's kind of why I think they decided to put this little unfortunate joke together. So the bank says, well, you know, she really did find this pot of gold. You know, in our little bank, we'll probably have to have security to guard a pot of gold. So they go out and look, and what do they find?
They find the full of dirt.
Okay, and what do they do? Tell her?
They do not tell her, you know, because she's bringing everybody in, so they're going to let her find out.
Yeah, that's very nice of them, right? So they tie it back up. She sees it, and of course she notices right away, because she's someone who's been hunting for a pot of gold for a long time in her backyard, that that's not how she tied up the pot. You know, that they had tied the bow in the wrong place. She knew where she tied the knot, blah, blah, blah. She's got to remember, you know, told her, sit and gather everybody around. She opened it when you see when everybody's here. So she was really careful about making sure that she put it in a place that was safe, so everyone can come out and see it. Lo and behold, everyone comes to see it. What happens?
She opens it up. She says that somebody stole her gold because it was full of dirt.
It's full of dirt because the knot had changed. So it makes sense to her and her reasoning. And you can understand, hey, that's not how I left it. Of course, this did have a fat gold, and now it doesn't, so someone must have stole it. She basically just goes crazy. She had a prior history of mental illness, and she starts, you know, beating people and, you know, has to be pulled back and restrained and pretty much lives the rest of her days until she dies, convinced that someone had stolen her pot of gold, and is just really distressed by it. So not only was it her own distress and some severe undoing, but they also really intended it to be a public humiliation for her. I mean, it's really, kind of plain right nasty to someone who, you know, has, you know, have a frail mental disposition. So I think in this case, you kind of see, again, the court being motivated by, this just seems way beyond what we would normally expect people to do to each other, and they should have known. In fact, that was their intention, was to cause this kind of emotional distress. It's not fair when they have her have this kind of repercussion to be able to get off liability. All right, so why don't our other torts work? Why no battery?
No contact.
No contact. Why no assault? There's no even threat of contact in any way, shape, or form. It's just, you know, here's the pot of gold. It's not really there. Why no false imprisonment? Well, she's not confined anywhere with her her pot of gold. She's just free to go at any point in time. And negligence, again, we're really intentional behavior, and we're not subjecting anyone to a risk of harm by this other than the emotional one. So it's really not negligence. All right, so again, I think it's just really the court being having this manifest need to try and remedy what would seem like to anyone an obvious result of pretty nasty intentional behavior. All right. Okay, one thing to note, both these cases are kind of the abnormal ones. Most times when plaintiffs allege an intentional infliction of emotional distress, it often is like the throwaway claim, the thing you add in that you don't really prevail on. Most plaintiffs do not recover an intentional infliction of emotional distress. The casebook author notes some pretty extreme examples of behavior in notes 7 and 8. 8's where they recover, 7's where they not. And it's really hard in a lot of ways to decide why one fits in the category of cases they don't recover and why they recover in others. But we're going to talk about these as we continue through the two actual main cases here. But keep in the back of your mind, the two main cases are unusual in that they prevail. All right, so Dickens, what do we have here? What I want to do is write down the actual behavior we have in this situation, because we do have a lot of things going on. It would be like a ripe for a great intentional tort exam question if we were to cover that again this semester, which we're not. But just so you know, this is a good review for you. What happened in this case in Dickens versus Puryear? What's all the conduct here? Because if we're label all the tortious conduct, there's lots and lots and lots of torts in this situation. Give me anyone. Yeah. Megan.
So the plaintiff was turned out to by defendants.
And his wife, yeah.
And his wife, yes. Wife left.
First of all, why are they luring him out here? Or as the court says, sharing alcohol, marijuana, and sex. Very court way of putting that, yes. That made them a little irritated. So they lure him out there. Wife doesn't want to stay around there. What happens?
So the wife leaves, and then the defendant calls out a foreman wearing masks.
It's pretty terrifying. I mean, you know, whatever you think about his initial behavior, this is not like a situation of, oh, no, I think someone's upset with me, and it's terrifying. Okay. Okay. They do? They cut his hair. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what I want to do for just a moment is try and identify what we actually see as the claims that they have in this case. If you were to take this, like, let's say you took this client on, you know, what kind of claims do you think you'd bring in this scenario and go from there? So what kind of claims do you think you have? What about cutting hair? What, is that a claim or is that not a claim? Good, it's a battery. Why is it a battery, even though it's their hair?
Contact.
Yeah, it's offensive contact. Your hair counts as your person. So this is a battery. All right, what about beatings? Yeah, that's the classic battery. What about handcuffing him to the farm equipment? Excellent. He literally gets kind of little participation most days. I'm like, Lynn early just participate. All right, threat with a knife for the castration. What's that? Good. I'm sorry? If they're beating you with it, it's a battery. When they're, like, just brandishing it, it's an assault.
You get the, well, it was like nightsticks, but yeah, I don't know if they had a gun in there, but if they did, yes, certainly. That would be an assault, just like with a knife. So, I mean, we keep it added in. It doesn't really matter. That would also be an assault. What about this one? Go home. Take your telephone off the wall. Better leave the entire state. Or you'll die. Okay, well, first of all, why is it not a battery? Why isn't this an assault? Okay, why isn't it imminent? Yeah, it's a future threat. Remember, conditional threats, future threats of harm are not considered assault. All right, the other one, why isn't it false imprisonment? He's not allowed to stay in the state any longer. That's right. Remember, exclusion is not false imprisonment. Keeping someone... You guys are doing excellent. I'm going to ask for all my classes to be at 9 p.m. Just teach now, like 11:30, and do a turbo speed. They're doing great. All right. So take the telephone off the wall and leave the state or die is nothing. All right, so the big question here ends up being, how do we characterize this claim? Can we characterize it as another tort? Because the real issue is one of, does he have a claim on which he can sue? And that's an odd question, given we've identified quite a lot of claims he could sue under. Why is that the issue?
Mm-hmm. Statute of limitations.
Okay, good. And what was the statute of limitations here?
1 year on assault battery and 3 years on
Was it 3 years on an infliction of emotional distress? That's the weird thing here. That's not actually listed under statute of limitations.
On general injury under tort. All right, so normally we have statute of limitations, one that's narrow, one that's broad. Which one do you have to apply? Yeah, if there's one that's more discreet and more narrow, you need to apply that one. So if it's even remote that this can fit the more narrow statute, it should be applied. We actually saw that way back when we had the case of the friend, the other one in the rear, and they say, look, we're trying to stylize it as negligence to get under the same kind of statute of limitations, a general injury one. They say, no, no, that's battery. We can't restylize something just to avoid the statute of limitations. I'll get to it again in just a moment, but realize that's why we're at this issue. Because if it is any of these categories, battery, assault, false imprisonment, the statute of limitations had run. So on these, the statute of limitation had run. It was a 1 year. All right, so he wants to try and get around the generic 3 year one. So he argued you should use intentional infliction of emotional distress. So what are the elements he has to prove? Well, they look to the restatement, second, on 653, and realize this is in the 80s, so it'd been around for a little while, but this is a good case to kind of express why the legislature hadn't fully filled the gap here, because they didn't even have a statute of limitations addressing this specific claim, and these claims are not as frequent as they might otherwise seem from the material, and the courts are still kind of filling in those gaps. But what were the elements that they had? What do you have to show? Yeah. Okay, good. Let's start with that one. That's the first element, that you have extreme, outrageous, right? Okay, intent. So either intentionally or what other kind of conduct can you do to cause it? Well, knows a substantial certainty is permitted in there as well. The other one, if you look at the restatement second on the top of 653, and this is the odd thing that we're actually going to address mostly on Friday, it's not just intention, which could be either purpose or knowledge of substantial certainty, just like we had. What was it? Yeah, or reckless. Or reckless. So for now, just kind of leave this one as a, we're going to get to it. And see how it comes in. This is the general way, intention. We're going to see the stylization and recklessness soon. Okay, so intent, and then the last bit. Good. So fear, emotional distress. All right. Now we already know what the word intention means and how you define it, just like we defined it last semester is how you define it here. So that means purpose or desire. Or a knowledge of substantial certainty. It means purpose or desire. Or a knowledge of substantial certainty. You'll see some permutation of these elements in different jurisdictions, but this is a good kind of list of elements.
All right, remember when I told you the rubric I gave you for intentional torts, act, intent, result, kind of fits everything? Let's say you never studied intentional infliction of emotional distress. Could you still say we've got an act, intent, and result? Yeah, the act is just kind of cabin because it's an unusual tort, and the act has to be extreme and outrageous. We have intent, and we have a result. See? So every time you come across any intentional tort, that's always what it's going to have. Some activity, generally just generic act. Here, special kind of act. Intention, resulting. And what you're targeting here is severe emotional stress. Yeah? Recklessness is something beyond negligence. We're going to deal with negligent infliction of emotional distress, which is actually like true, pure unreasonableness. Recklessness is somewhere in between. It's sort of that wantonness. Sometimes gross negligence fits in it. So it's if you're thinking of a spectrum of fault, intention is high wrongdoing. Reckless is the lowest that we still commit unless you consider strict liability in the equation. Recklessness is somewhere in the middle. And the cases we deal with on Friday are actually going to define that for us a bit more. So today we're just dealing with more of like, it's what I meant to have happen, my desire, the easier one. But we will see this tort, unlike our other intentional torts, does permit recovery for recklessness. Remember, you couldn't be reckless with respect to battery, with respect to contact you'd have with another and still the battery. You really needed to be intentional. With intentional infliction of emotional stress, we're going to see some potential gift. Or maybe not. That's Friday. All right. Okay, so big aspects of this are, is it extreme and outrageous? Our next case is going to help us delve into a little bit more of what extreme and outrageous is. But let's talk about it with this one for now. Extreme and outrageous, kind of the funny thing the court uses to describe it is, would you stand up as a person and yell, outrageous, when you heard about the I don't know how good of a litmus test that is, because it's very much, very subjective, and I think a lot of these cases are, but it's definitely beyond, even beyond the more than the average kind of insult. It has to be, you know, worse than just, wow, that's really bad behavior. It has to just be like, I expected almost from this that someone would have had severe emotional distress. All right, so why would you say this, and realize we're talking about this one, was extreme and outrageous? Take your phone off your wall, leave the state, or die. Why is it extreme and outrageous? Okay, good. I mean, so in a lot of ways, the fact that it is the open-ended kind of threat doesn't give him a chance to ever feel like he reaches a point of safety. Very good. Anything else that makes this particularly extreme and outrageous? Yeah. I mean, think about it. All the stuff that he went through. Do you think that there's any less likelihood he was suffering from extreme and outrageous conduct from... like, I don't know, being threatened with a knife with castration than this threat? I mean, really, when I look at what happened to him, this one to me seems like bad, but not nearly as bad as some of the other things he was facing. But that's just me. The odd part about this is, can he recover from any of the emotional effect of this? He can't loop it into this?
Yeah.
No, he can't. Anything that's emotionally tied to these... is subsumed in those torts. It's the appended injury. And therefore, those are barred under the statute of limitations. But the interesting thing is, when he defines this one as extreme and outrageous, he's allowed to let the jury consider everything that happened in coming to that conclusion. He just can't recover from the emotional distress from this. So how do you prevent that from happening? Do you know what you do? How do you get the jury to say, you know, look only at, you can consider all this evidence, but look only at that. Basically what we do, give them what we call limiting instruction. You tell the jury, you're going to hear some evidence, but you're only to use this evidence with respect to determining whether or not the conduct is extremely outrageous and it shouldn't factor into your damages. Well, what do you think about that kind of instruction?
I think it's pretty persuasive.
You think it's very persuasive?
That they will use it in determining their...
You think they're going to ignore it, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
How many people think that it's going to be difficult for the jury to ignore the fact that he came upon this field that's being lured out there, swore masked men, beat him within inches of his life, threatened to castrate him, cut off his hair, brandish knife, keep him handcuffed to this machinery and say, oh, well, we're not going to think about that when we think about this threat to go you know, leave the state or die. I mean, it's very, very hard, but that's kind of basically what the jury is left with and the options the court is left with. Unless they decide that this really is something bound under the same statute of limitations and otherwise precluded. I have a hand check question. Do you have something? Okay. All right. So it kind of brings us back to the question of what is the court really trying to do here? Normally when you have a narrow statute of limitations, as I mentioned, you're supposed to roll, you know, not allow someone to get around it. Because you don't, I mean, think about it. If the defendant had actually just stopped here and shut up, and was just like, yeah, leave, ha ha, you know, you want more, don't ever come back, ha ha, just let him leave, would there have been an IID claim? Would this guy have gotten anything?
No. I mean, it's really like an artfully manufactured opinion here, where they seize on this last threat and tie everything to it. Because if he just shut up, let him loose, and go, everything would have been barred under the statute of limitations.
It's just because we have evidence of this that the plaintiff has an ability to get to the jury. And once this is, you know, this is being contested on statute of limitations, once they know this is going to the jury, I'm sure this settled. I don't think this case went forward. We're just trying to deal with the statute of limitations. This is very unlikely anyone would want to be before a court with this kind of information. Yeah?
Yeah, what about the context of what he did, 17-year-old, would that be admissible in front of the jury?
Well, when you learn in evidence, there is some situations that you can allow what we call like prior bad acts to come in, but they're generally very limited. And it really would be much more, I think, in this case, prejudicial than it is probative as to what happened. Because you don't have a defense for this kind of battery. You can't say he had a coming to him defense. You know, think about it, the only defenses you have are self-defense, you know, consent.
But even so, in front of a jury, you know, you say all these things.
That's why they don't let you say it. Because the probative value, what does it help you prove? No elements that are worthy at law of being considered because it's not a valid defense. It's not related to the prima facie case. The prejudice to the jury is going to outweigh it's not going to come in. But that's, you're going to cover that in evidence class. But yeah, so it won't come in. Because, you know, we just don't at law to say, hey, you know, this guy is sleeping with your wife, you can beat him like this, or I mean, with your daughter, I'm sorry, you can beat him with this. What you end up doing is you know, call the police, statutory rape. That's what you do. So, that's the law. Yes, that's the law. All right. So, you know, but the court seems to be actually pretty sympathetic to this individual. I mean, obviously, they're kind of making an end run around the statute of limitations to get this in. And why? Well, I think they probably just thought this was really outrageous behavior, and so they're opening this window to let this happen. In this particular jurisdiction, the intentional infliction of emotional distress was not written into any of the statutes of limitations. But arguably, I'd say if I was representing the defendants here, I would say this conduct is actually much more similar to that covered under the statute of limitations because it's intentional in behavior and therefore should fall under the one-year statute of limitations. We don't see that argument, at least in the printed opinion, and don't know whether or not they presented it. But the court clearly wasn't convinced enough to settle it under 1 year. So it comes in, only can get damages from this one, but realize they're going to hear evidence of the others to give context to whether it was extreme and outrageous. Any questions on that one at all? All right, let's turn then to the next case, equally egregious behavior. This is Littlefield versus McCuffey. Right here we actually have two different claims, and that's going to become important because there was actually some damages caps. We're going to still see the same general kind of construction elements for the tort claim, the state tort claim, but there's a federal claim going on here, one of the Federal Fair Housing Act. And it's going to become important because Illinois had a very unusual law that did not permit punitive damages in an IIED case. Most jurisdictions do permit punitive damages in intentional infliction of emotional stress for obvious reasons. What you're doing is extreme and outrageous, and so normally it's something we think of as falling under punitive behavior. So most jurisdictions actually permit punitive damages when you have an intentional infliction of emotional stress. Negligent, we'll see later, but intentional, yes. So they brought this under the both state law and the Fair Housing Act law because it didn't have similar limitations on damages. You could bring punitives under the federal law. All right, so what happens in this case? Yeah. Okay.
So, obviously, like you said, playing about to equal opportunity housing act, along with potential emotional distress.
Yeah, because there's a whole lot more behavior than just saying, I'm not going to rent to you.
Correct. Harassment would be number one.
So, what did they do?
She just, I guess that the landlord, she, as far as harassment,
mm-hmm. Like doing, yes.
He called her at work.
Yep.
Told her he couldn't rent it because of the boss. He used the pseudonym, but he was actually referring to himself.
Yes. Yes. He has lots of names for himself.
He told her that he changed the locks and put her things in the street.
Which he did.
And he threatened her sister as well.
He actually went to the sister's house and threatened her there. I mean, I think if you look, there's a, the court does a really good job, I think, of numbering each of the, where is that in the opinion, each of the actual behaviors they do. He has a litany of just, you know, erratic behavior. Oh, on 660, you know, immediately removing the belongings from the apartment, exposing them to theft and vandalism because he leaves them out there, subjecting her to public ridicule and humiliation after she pays her deposit and fixes up the apartment. Numerous blatantly racist, harassing phone calls. And these were like several in a day at times. And she'd just pick up the phone and have racial slurs and just really, you know, just abhorrent, disgusting behavior on the phone. He calls her at work. He goes to the sister's home. And of course, you know, as they say, of course, there's also the death threat that he posts on their door to her husband. And so if you think about it, I mean, like, there's just a lot of behavior that's going to be qualified under intentional infliction of emotional distress. Now, the jury awards her two different types of damages. $50,000 compensatory damages, which she's going to challenge, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and punitives in the amount of $100,000. Right, so you have to have the federal claim here to get the punitives, because Illinois' intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, as I mentioned, didn't permit those. So you have $50,000 in compensatory, $100,000 in punitives. Now, without going into the federal act very much, because it's not really a tort, this is like a slam dunk for federal fair housing acts. I mean, these are the kind of the claims that like you just don't see, because it's not even hidden racial motivation. He sees the Bruce. Bruce comes to the door, and at that moment, he says, all deals are off. He makes those crazy references to himself, the boss, the old man, runs out to somebody else. And then goes straight into racial slurs and says she can't work. And that is like about as classic as you can get to fair housing. You know, normally, most of the cases actually that I saw in the federal courts are where people are using like pretextual reasons, like I did a credit check, it wasn't good, you know, oh, I thought I could do this, but it's not going to work, oh, there's, you know, 6,000 different reasons, little tiny things that you couldn't exactly fit, and so therefore I'm not renting to you. This is like just blatant, because of your race, I'm not renting to you.
Did he also say that he actually did a credit check, and that's why?
But he lies because he never actually did one. Yeah, most, oh yeah, later, actually in the lawsuit, but not at the time. Now, most of these claims, actually people do engage in that behavior, and then later the plaintiff is left to have to dispute that that's actually the reasons. They call it pretextual, and it's a bunch of burden shifting. And if you ever take a federal claims course or a 1983 class, you'll see these claims, and there's a lot of burden shifting in them to present them. All right. So that's why we have the intentional infliction of emotional stress claim. Because if he had just denied the rent to the apartment, we really wouldn't. Being a racist or a bigot is not enough to have an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. It's not good behavior. We don't want it. We don't want to condone it, obviously. But for most cases of extreme and outrageous behavior, right now the courts are not giving that enough for intentional infliction of emotional distress. It's that he went so far beyond that. He has all the calls. He has the death threat on the door. He has going to the sister's house. All of these things make it much more extreme. If you look at it, like if you look at note 7, there's a case that's fairly similar. The last one they have bullet pointed there, the Dawson case. The Carroll case is also pretty similar, where the fire inspector, for racial reasons, doesn't allow or concludes that the fire was one of arson and not one of coverage under the insurance policy, but it was because of racially motivated reasons. Under both of those cases, even though there's clear racial overtones, the court does not allow it to be considered extreme and emotional behavior. Looking back to the first case we had, the Dickens case versus Puryear, which had some of the undertones of adulterous affairs. You have there the priest in the first case, the Osborne, this one is the Galenstein case, who engages in a relationship with people he's counseling, and even there, not considered extreme and outrageous. So if you take a look at it, it's a very, like, pretty extreme behavior that doesn't quite rise to the level of extreme and outrageous. Why do these cases not, and the McGuffey case and the Dickens case do? It's really just a subjective call. Man, there's no good bright line I can give you. Just the more incidents you can count for your client that it suggests extreme conduct and really support that it was a non-accidental, a true intentional meaning for that kind of distress, the more likely you are to get over that hurdle to be considered an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. All right, let's look at his arguments. His first one really is that she didn't have any physical injury. She didn't have any physical injury. Now, you do see some discussion of it, like the nausea in there, he's kind of taking issue with that, saying there's no physical injury, no physical manifestation. Like I said, tuck that away, because that's going to really come up in negligent infliction of emotional distress. Most IIED claims, look, all we say is severe. We don't say has to have any physical attribute. So you have to show that it's not just like I was upset, or that even a reasonable person would be upset, but that it was extreme or severe emotional distress. If you look at the Jones v. Clinton case, part of the reason that she can't recover is that she doesn't have severe emotional distress. Remember the fact they looked to say she wasn't under severe emotional distress? She went back to work. She had several meetings with him. In fact, one right before she files the claim. She never reports to anyone else that it had occurred. She waited multiple years. Never had any interruption or incident that affected her marriage in relation to it. And her relationships carried on in a normal manner. So when you're talking to clients about, you know, these kinds of claims, when you're asking them about it, realize you're going to have to delve into some very, very, like, intimate, difficult conversations about how this behavior actually affected their life. Because if you can't demonstrate that it really did cause some sort of disruption, you're not going to be able to show severe emotional stress. Now, of course, if you are being treated by a therapist or can show some actual documented physical injury, you don't have trouble with it. Most people don't. Most people just, you know, say, it really troubled me. You could think it would, but you have to show something that you can prove that actually is some sort of evidence of severe emotional injury. So you can start to see by the cases that are in the notes just how hard this is to prove. Because if you take on its face value what happened, as Jones pled it in Jones v. Clinton, it wasn't just a minor event. And yet the court still says there it's not sufficient enough to rise to the severe, either extreme and outrageous, or to severe emotional distress. All right, defendant's other challenge. Well, one is the compensatory damages. He says, look, these are excessive. $50,000 is excessive for not getting an apartment let out to you. What do they say in that? How do they say that she really comes up with something that's not excessive, at least even if you would have come to a different number? What does she do? What does she lose in compensation?
Yeah,
she put the deposits down, so they had some money. She painted the apartment. If you can say there's any kind of damage to her property while it's out there. I mean, really, I think this end is where it's harder to justify because, you know, I don't think the deposits she paid or even the paint, if you added up all the hours they spent to any kind of property damage, probably not quite at $50,000, but not enough to say it's excessive such we're going to overturn the jury's verdict. The part that's clearly there, I think, is the punitive. He just doesn't want it because he says, IAD, no punitive damages. See why this claim was so important? They had the federal claim as well. Because really, I think if she only had the compensatories, it kind of probably would be a little suspect. But the conduct is so crazy that it makes a good support for punitive damages. And federal law permits it. And they say, look, this is the kind of case we want. Because it's not even just, you know, we're going to unlawfully not let the apartment to you on the basis of racism, but that we're going to harass you consistently, persistently, even after you left, including going to your relative's place of, you know, of their dwelling and threaten them. So that's why the punitive damages stick. They're authorized by federal law. They're not going to be capped. The last bit is under the federal law, there had been a cap at the time that the complaint was entered. This went over that cap. It was under new law. And the court, in kind of a cavalier way, to be honest, says we're not going to apply it. We're going to apply the new law because it's not going to cause prejudice to you. Note, in most cases, if there's conduct and you're under one cap, that's the cap that gets stuck with, not a new one. Especially if the cap has gotten higher for the defendant as opposed to low. So it is, they don't really tell us exactly why or how they come to that conclusion legally, but that's what they do. Yeah. Yeah, if it's punitive in nature, you're generally subject to what was there when you were doing your behavior, unless the statute has something in it that says that they're not going to, you know, grandfather in all the claims up to the new thing. But typically, if that language isn't there and it's punishment oriented, it's more fair to the defendant to stick with the original. This is what you think. The idea is, you know, when I did this behavior, this was the amount you'd ever have to pay. And now I'm going to be subject to this. The court doesn't really explain other than saying it's just not going to cause them injury. They off it. I think partly because, again, like those old cases before IAD, they just see this behavior as being so egregious that they're wanting the jury award to stick. They're kind of manufacturing their way around it. Last, attorney's fees. He says, hey, you shouldn't be getting these attorney's fees, and they seem unreasonable, and he gives a calculation to try and reduce it. Note here, do you normally get attorney's fees when you're a plaintiff and successful, like in tort? You say, now you have to owe my attorney's fees? Not in America. In Europe, yes, and it's a huge deterrent to cases, and a lot of other foreign countries too. They kind of find us off, because we all pay our own fees, which doesn't deter plaintiffs from coming after you because you have to pay your own fees, plaintiff pays his own fees. But under federal statutes, sometimes we alter this balance, and this is one in which we do because we really want to discourage this kind of behavior. So normally under these cases, it's like I said, it's just the I'm not leasing this property to you, then you get sued and you get to collect attorney's fees. Sometimes we even double and treble our damages under these kinds of statutes to make this thing so, you know, significant enough. This one's punitives and it's attorney's fees, so it's extra stings. Understand? Want to deter this kind of behavior. All right, but note that's normally not, it would normally not occur for IAD claims because that, the attorney's fees, is coming out of the federal claim. All right, not under normal IAD. So take away from this, same kind of concept for an intentional tort. When we define the word intent, it's the same way we've defined it before, purpose, desire, knowledge of substantial certainty, but that you have to show extreme and outrageous behavior. And take note of those cases. It actually has to be quite extreme to be a claim that you're liable to. And then severe emotional distress, it helps if you have physical harm, but not required. Just has to be something that you're going to try and point to more than just, I was upset. Like disruption in work, disruption in normal lifestyle, that your relationships have been disrupted. If you do have something physical, great. If you've been treated poor, great. The more you can get that for your clients, the better. I realize these are not easy claims to help clients through, because no one wants to talk about that. How many times your stomach upset? Do you have nice ones? Can you sleep at all? Because they're not pleasant things. And realize they're going to have to talk about that on the stand.
Something that the simplest disruption of life is considered severe emotional distress.
Yeah, but it has to be like a real disruption, not just like, you know, I found myself distracted. So most people try and show, like, I was unable to actually go to work, I felt like I was frightened, I couldn't leave my house. You know, that's what you're really looking at. Because your average, I was really highly offended, and it really, like, you know, weighed on me, morale's not enough. It has to be severe. Like, you're really showing that like, this person is injured. Okay. So you're looking for lost work. Like, in the Jones case, Jones v. Clinton, they were looking for, like, her actual relationship with her husband. they have any kind of marital problems because of it. They seek counseling because of it. Because I wasn't there, they said it's not severe. All right. So a lot of times you also want to talk to people about COVID documentation, those kinds of injuries you had. All right, Friday, make sure you read from the recklessness. We're going to go ahead and end tonight. You did a great job. Sorry it's so late.